A conversation on the issues you really care about. Provocative ideas and opinion from decision makers, authors, experts, and from you. This is the podcast recap of Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm your host, Neil Conan.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Allstate, who is committed to helping reduce the number of teens who die behind the wheel. Learn more about safer teen driving at allstate.com/teen.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's beginning to seem like old times, and not in a good way. Relations between Moscow and Washington have become so chilly of late that some talk of a new Cold War. There's been angry language from both sides over a range of issues: nuclear missiles, strategic missile defense, arms control, human rights, the independence of Kosovo, and Iran's nuclear ambitions. The Kremlin has been accused of starting a cyber war against NATO ally Estonia, and Britain charges one former KGB officer with the murder of another former Soviet spy in London. In an effort to warm up relations, President Bush invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to visit his father's summer home in Kennebunkport, Maine. Today we'll look at the declining relationship between Russia and the United States. Later in the hour, sleep and why so many of us don't get enough of it. What's your excuse? Send us an email, talk@npr.org. But first, why relations with Russia seem to be as bad as they've been since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Lilia Shevtsova. She's senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we heard the Russian foreign minister and the secretary of state trading barbs. President Putin was talking today about a new arms race. Is this just rhetoric, or is things as bad as they sound?
Well, things are really bad. And I haven't remembered the relationship be so cold during the last 15 years. But still, it's not the Cold War, and due to several reasons. During the Cold War, there were two powers, superpowers, that were fighting each other desperately for their preponderance and for hegemony. And they were fighting each other to get their philosophy and ideology to get it dominant. Mm-hmm. It was the fight between Marxism, communism on the one side, and liberal democracy. So far, Russia rejected any claims to be a communist power. And now, so far, at least on the verbal level, Russia has endorsed liberal democracy in its constitution as the major standard and system of values. And there are some other reasons why Russia and United States cannot go for war. Asymmetry of resources. Russian military budget is $20 billion. And the Soviet Union spent on military needs one-third of its GDP. Russia now is spending only a little bit more than 2.7%. And besides, there is one very important and maybe ironic thing. Neil, you'll smile now. Russian political elite and Russian business are very much pro-West, and despite of the fact that our relations are so chilly. Hmm. And that's the irony, and that's the paradox. Because on the one hand, Russian political leaders, people in the Kremlin and around the Kremlin, they would like to be a kind of Roman Abramovich on the personal and corporative level. They want to be integrated into the West, to have their families in the West, to have their banking accounts in American and Western banks. And at the same time, they would like to close Russia for the Western impact. So they want to have it both ways, mm-hmm. to be pro-Western and to be anti-American in Russia.
Now, this range of issues that we mentioned earlier, and we'll get into them in more detail a bit later, but given this range of issues, Iran, Kosovo, weapons of various types, is this an accumulation of individual issues, or is there some underlying factor, underlying all of this that speaks to the hostility that we've seen of late?
I would say underlying factor is very powerful, and the underlying factor is we organize ourselves, I mean Russia and America, on a different basis. Still we have this, you know, systemic, structural, existential difference. We built in Russia our system, first of all, on the premise of the state and monopoly of power. You, America, built your system on a different principle, on a different standard. So incompatibilities between us are structural. And at the same time, these incompatibilities, of course, influence all other values and common interests. And having these, you know, incompatible principles that we follow, of course, this fact influences all other issues, all other foreign policy questions.
Let's get into some of the specifics. And joining us also here in Studio 3A is Daryl Kimball, Executive Director of the Arms Control Association, which is a think tank based here in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you on the program as well.
My pleasure.
And there is the dispute lately. Vladimir Putin says the United States is starting a new arms race by the installation of this, as it's described, a very modest ballistic missile defense system. It's yet to be installed, but there's talk of installing it with a radar in the Czech Republic and some missile silos in Poland. Is this a new arms race?
Well, not yet. And we're not, I would agree with Lilia, we're not in a new Cold War, but the plan to deploy 10 interceptors in Poland along with a specialized radar in the Czech Republic in the next 3 to 4 years by the Bush administration has roiled Russia. They are concerned that as their strategic nuclear arsenal shrinks and as the United States retains the capability to reconstitute a large part of its arsenal in the future, their strategic nuclear retaliatory capability could be compromised. Now, we're a long, long way from there, but they're concerned about that. They're also concerned about how they see this as a pattern, part of a pattern. NATO was expanded in the 90s. The United States is planning to work with Romania and Bulgaria to build military bases there. There's the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Russia sees the Western military infrastructure knocking at their door.
So a continuation of the old policy of containment and encroaching it.
Right. And so the missile defense proposal is kind of the icing on the cake, and it is something that does need to be resolved. I think we cannot simply wish Russia's concerns away, because they can do some things that are negative to global security and their own security.
Well, again, those overall issues, but this radar, this limited ballistic missile defense system, I think it was just the other day that the Russians fired this new missile, the RS-24, which they said would be capable of overwhelming and defeating any possible ballistic missile shield that the United States could erect, and Secretary of State Rice laughingly said, "We completely agree. This isn't designed for that. This is designed to protect against missile launches from Iran or North Korea."
Well, I mean, from the U.S. perspective, we are no longer enemies, and Russia should have nothing to fear from the United States' very substantial nuclear and strategic military capabilities. But Russia sees it in another way, and it is not so much the intentions as the capabilities that they seem to be looking at. And what Russia sees, and I think there are some validity to this, is that the United States is saying that this missile defense system is designed to deal with a future North Korean or Iranian missile threat. That threat doesn't exist now. With respect to Iran, it's not going to exist for at least another decade. That's worrisome, but Russia's wondering, well, why is this being built on this fast schedule? The Bush administration wants to start pouring concrete within the next 2 years. They are suspicious, and perhaps they're using this as an excuse to bring up other issues, but they are troubled.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests again are Lilia Shevtsova of the Moscow Carnegie Center and Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association. And let's begin with Rolf. Rolf is with us from Woodridge, Illinois.
I would like to comment on why I think the relationships are at a low point. And my feeling is that it was the Bush administration's overzealous policy of embracing Putin in the early part of the Bush administration that has set the stage for the situation that we're in now. Certainly the invasion of Iraq and our unilateral policies of invasion have added to that. But I think it's caused Putin and the Russian leaders to feel a lot more nervous about the intentions of the United States. And I think we should have taken a much more cautious approach towards Russia in the early years by encouraging them to develop their democracy, but I think the Bush administration's approach towards them set the stage for now a retrenchment of our relationship and foreign policy with them.
Lilia Shevtsova, we all remember the line about George Bush looking into Mr. Putin's soul.
Oh, right. Yes. Now he apparently will think twice about that. Maybe looking into Putin's soul, he'll find something else. But we'll see. They will meet on July the 1st, and it will be occasion for President Bush to look again into Mr. Putin's soul.
Let me ask you a question. These are both men who are at the twilight of their presidencies. As we know, there will be a new election in this country in 2008. Mr. Putin faces, he's not eligible to run. He can't run again.
No, he cannot.
And has made no effort thus far to, as many feared, change the Constitution, so he could. So he is on his way out as well.
That's true. So they both are lame duck.
And how does that affect the ongoing relationships?
Well, it affects in a direct way. They cannot change the trajectory in the relationship. And apparently, the both leaders, what they can do, they could do damage control, and they could simply prevent the relationship from sliding down even further.
Mm-hmm.
But hardly they can invent any initiative.
I wanted to ask you, Daryl Kimball, as they talk, are there going to be, is there possibility for, you know, important resolutions at this meeting coming up in July?
Well, I think there are possibilities. I mean, there are discussions underway on several of these military issues. First of all, one of the things the Bush administration did early on, President Bush looked into his eyes, Putin's eyes, was to say that the two countries can reduce their strategic nuclear arsenals much lower. But Bush preferred to do this not through a treaty, as Reagan and Gorbachev and Bush's father did, but through a handshake agreement known as the Moscow Treaty. The Russians were not pleased with that. They wanted more certainty. And so one of the issues that has come up once again is whether the two sides should extend or allow the 1991 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty to expire. This was an older treaty. And if that expires, there will be less certainty about what each other is doing because it contains a lot of important verification provisions. So those talks right now are going on at the expert level. There is an opportunity to raise this up at the Kennebunkport meeting, and maybe some progress can be made.
In the few seconds before we go to a break, Lilia Shevtsova, getting back to Rolf's questions, were expectations too high in the beginning, and does that lead to the situation where we are now?
I don't think that there were high expectations at the beginning of the Bush-Putin tenure. It seems to me the problem was, and our listener rightly pointed it out, Bush tried to pursue towards Russia realpolitik without thinking, apparently, about the word D, and never apparently trying to persuade President Putin to follow his and Russia's commitments. Democracy commitments.
Rolf, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We'll talk more with Lilia Shevtsova and Daryl Kimball. I'm Neil Conan. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about sleep and why we don't get enough of it. You can email us the reason why you tell yourself you didn't have to get 8 hours last night, talk@npr.org. But right now, we're looking at the declining relationship between the U.S. and Russia and the prospects of what some call a new Cold War. Our guests are Lilia Shevtsova, senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center, and Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association. If you have questions about relations between the two countries or how bad it might get, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Here's an email from Mark in Buffalo, New York. Is this Russian behavior, natural gas, games, etc., a clever, quicker, self-identified way to nudge themselves back into a global leadership role? Lilia?
Well, I don't think that even the most aggressive part of the Russian leadership are not that pragmatic, and they don't understand that apparently Russia is not that powerful, even with all these energy resources, that, well, it should pretend to be a global power again. But definitely Russia wants to be a regional superpower.
And that's perhaps behind the reason behind what everybody believes was Russia's role in that cyber war against Estonia.
Well, it's difficult to tell who is initiating these cyber attacks on Estonian websites because, well, cyber attacks became a powerful instrument that is being used by all political forces in Russia, but quite possibly that the government has started to be the initiator.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Dan. Dan's with us from Rochester, Minnesota.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am wondering what's the current status of the Russian military capabilities, technology, how they rank with the United States, and the overall size of their naval and land forces.
Daryl Kimball, the Russian armed forces were in precipitous decline for many years. Are they in a state of revival?
Well, I would say that they're not anywhere close to where the United States is with respect to conventional military forces. But Russia still has very sizable ground forces, a large navy by global standards, and of course they have the world's largest nuclear weapons arsenal. One of the issues that is aggravating U.S.-Russian relations right now is. Is an issue related to the conventional forces of Russia and the former and NATO countries in Europe. There was a 1990 treaty that limited the former Warsaw Pact countries and the NATO countries' number of tanks and troops. It's one of the most important agreements that helped end the Cold War. There was an agreement in 1999 to revise it. Russia very much wants these revisions, but the NATO countries are not moving ahead with that adapted treaty because Russia has not pulled out troops as it pledged from Moldova and Georgia. And this is one of the things that Vladimir Putin has said Russia may not observe in a year if there's not a resolution.
That's so the CFE agreement, Conventional Forces in Europe.
So the forces are not anywhere close to where the United States is in terms of numbers and capabilities, but with respect to European security, they are still a very significant factor.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you also a follow-up on a specific case, and that regards Kosovo. Russia has been a longtime ally of Serbia. The UN arbitrator, the Finnish leader, Antti Niinistö, I think is pronounced, I think I got that wrong, but close enough. But they've recommended basically that Kosovo get independence. This is going before the Security Council. Russia is, well, all but openly threatening a veto if that's the case.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, this is, it's not clear to me whether Russia is reflexively supporting its old Cold War ally Serbia here, whether it has legitimate concerns about the new plan that the West backs. But, you know, this is another example of the host of issues that have not been resolved between the two countries, and Russia seems to be, to me, flexing its muscles as a way of gaining attention and forcing the West to respond to Russia's longstanding concerns.
Does that make sense to you, Lilia?
Yes, definitely. I would agree with Daryl. And there is one more issue in this context. You know, Serbia, again, the new political leadership of Serbia, is playing with Russia, just like Milosevic had done, trying to use Russia in its own political gimmicks. And it seems to me it's up to the West and European community and the United States to find their own leverage, you know, with Serbian leadership, and simply invite Serbia to join the European community.
Yes.
That will be a great trump card that will force to change the situation.
Yet at a meeting in Europe, excuse me, this week, when Secretary Rice, in fact, mentioned the prospect of inviting Serbia
it's
to join the...
It's a very prudent approach.
And Foreign Minister Lavrov practically blanched on the stage.
You know what? I don't think that Russia would be very aggressive, and I'm not sure that Russia definitely will veto in the Security Council if China will abstain. So a lot depends on the big brother China.
Big brother China. There's a change. Thanks very much for the call, Dan.
Thank you for taking it.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go to, this is Andy. Andy's calling us from Germany.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question for the guests about Russia's demographic problem, how the population is basically collapsing, and if you read some things, there won't even be a Russia in X years in the future. Are they feeling that pressure at the government level, and is that impacting the relationship?
Lilia Shevtova.
Yes, this is really a very dramatic issue. Our population still declines, and if the current trends continue, in 70 years' time, we apparently will have approximately 100 million people, which is not going to be enough in order to keep Russia's federation in the current geographical format. So the major problem is apparently somehow to solve the problem. Current government understands the problem, but, you know, with all reforms put on the back burner, I don't think that, you know, Putin's and his team that are leaving the scene have any kind of adequate solution to the demographic problem.
Thank you very much, Andy. Just follow up on that. Putin and his team leaving the scene. Are Putin and his team really leaving the scene, or is he going to be the power behind the throne of whichever person becomes the next president of Russia?
Now, you have definitely an existential question for us Russians. Well, it's totally unthinkable that Putin will leave the scene at least 1 year after he is gone, because there will be a lot of continuity of the policy, continuity of the regime, and of course his folks, his team, will be in the Kremlin. So for him, apparently, there will be a possibility to play the role of the Russian Deng Xiaoping, but only for a very brief period of time, because Russia does not understand duality of power. Mm-hmm. And so the Tsar who is elected will be the Tsar already beyond year 2009. So the new leader, the new regime will be installed pretty soon.
But isn't that person likely to be one of Putin's acolytes? Everybody's talking about the defense minister, Ivanov.
Well, apparently there are several candidates, and Ivanov, the former defense minister, is one of the most important and influential presidential hopefuls. But at the same time, President Putin, wishing not to be lame duck at the decline of his tenure, can get out a joker out of his sleeve or pocket any moment.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to line six. And line six is Bob. Bob calling us from Oklahoma.
Interesting discussion. Speaking of duality, most of the people in the world are trying to move away from that concept. And that brings me to the point that I'm trying to make, is that what was said earlier about these two leaders being lame ducks and their influence, whether or not they have any or not. My goodness, at this point in time, with global warming and human rights at stake all over the world, these two leaders should step up to the plate and deal with these things that they could have some influence on, instead of continuing to militarize. You know, that's my point.
Mm, are they
to that, please?
When they get to Kennebunkport in July, are they going to be talking about the issues that we've been talking about and the sniping that's been going on from both sides, Lilia Shevtova? Or are they going to get to these broader issues that Bob is asking about?
Hardly. It seems to me Daryl was right. They would be speaking about security issues, and they will be trying to tone down the general criticism, because hardly both leaders would like to leave the political scene having such a complicated legacy, having, you know, the elements of the Cold Peace in the relationship between Russia and America.
Can I just make a follow-up comment?
Go ahead, please.
Yes, I think that's just rubbish. I think if we want to grind the world into extinction in terms of the human race and habitat for other species, they'll do that. Otherwise, they'll step up to the plate and deal with the issues that most of the people in the world want them to deal with.
Bob, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, bye-bye. Here's an email from Marianne in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. I would like to know your opinion on the Nashi movement members trying to physically attack Estonia's ambassador to Russia in Moscow, a violation of international law. I'm Estonian, was extremely angry and scared of the riots a few weeks ago. If you watch the local Estonian news, the riots and what happened afterwards was shocking. Many Russians in Estonia are good. However, the young disenfranchised are angry, and at one point some Russians stopped their cars downtown, blocking traffic, lying that their cars were broken down. Suddenly all the cars were broken. As you, Daryl Kimball, as you look at this confrontation, and I guess that's not too strong a word, between Estonia and Russia, clearly that's a problem that's not going away anytime soon.
Well, that's correct. And the United States and Russia have a number of issues upon which they differ. And I think that we have to take a look at the recent news headlines and understand what is leading to this harsher rhetoric. There have always been issues about democratization and what happens to the former Soviet republics. Those are very important. But I think what President Bush and the next president has to focus on is how can they resolve the residual Cold War weapons issues that are really heating this up. And just to take a cue from our caller a couple of minutes ago from Oklahoma, there are some things that they can do that are quite bold. You know, right now the United States and Russia have approximately 4,000 to 5,000 strategic nuclear missiles aimed at one another, many of which are on high alert. For me, 20 years after the Cold War or so, I mean, this is not a situation that makes too much sense. We're not enemies. We're not allies. We should both be moving down with these arsenals. They have the opportunity to do that in a much more serious and permanent fashion. So this is one of the key things that ought to be on the agenda, because that can, I think, lead to progress in many of these other difficult areas. And you certainly don't want to have these residual problems left over from the Cold War getting in the way of solving these other important issues like Estonia, democratization, and others.
Do Presidents Bush and Putin, though, have time to incorporate broad global aims, if you will, what's remaining in their tenures?
They do both have some time, especially President Bush, and they can also set the tone and the course for their successors. They may not be able to complete certain agreements, but they can begin the process.
Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association and Lilia Shevtsova, a senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center, are with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Les. Les on the line with us from California.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have some disagreements with both of the people, but I also have a question. The first, I have lived a fair amount of time in both the Soviet Union and Russia, families there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to point out that the dispute between Russia and the United States really occurred under the Clinton administration. And I can tell you when I was there that the dismay at the way the Clinton administration treated Russia was profound, because 15 years ago there was a lot of respect for the United States, there was a lot of love for the United States. That has all gone. Most of that had to do with the Clinton administration pushing policies to privatize what was happening in Russia and the Soviet Union, and pushing policies which basically aided actually what some people in Russia today call genocide of the Clinton administration. So I can tell you there was more feeling of positiveness toward the Bush than the Clinton administration. So that's one point I want to bring up.
When you talked about the genocide of the Clinton administration, you're talking about the war in Kosovo?
No, I'm talking about the dismantlement of the educational system, the dismantlement of the healthcare system, the dismantlement of the infrastructure, which was because of the privatization that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
This had to do with loans for shares for loans.
Okay.
Process that really dismantled much of what kept that society together. The reason why Putin has a very, very high popularity rating today is because he has reestablished many of these things, many of the things about the infrastructure. I go to Siberia every year, and I'm surprised. 6 years ago, there was a lot of money in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but that has flowed out. People are seeing the infrastructure actually being rebuilt under Putin, and that's why his popularity rating is so high. Most of the presidents, like Gorbachev, when they left the office, had a very low popularity rating.
And we're running out of time here, Les.
I would argue that Putin will be the power behind the throne simply because he is this person who's leaving the office with a high popularity rating, and it's very different than what happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
My question would be, what changes can the United States make? I mean, this is the important thing because I'm living here, and it seems to me the United States
had made
some agreements with the Soviet Union not to expand next to their borders, and they broke those agreements because they say it's no longer the Soviet Union, it's Russia, and they've broken a lot of agreements. It seems to me we could, in fact, make and have made arrangements to have a closer relationship with Russia if we, as the United States, would do certain things, certainly not putting missiles in Eastern Europe.
And we're going to have to stop you there if we're going to get a response at all. Bob, Les, I'm sorry, but Lilia Shevtsova.
That was a very interesting comment. Thank you, Les. Firstly, I would agree with you. Well, the chill started already during the Clinton-Yeltsin's tenure. In fact, Clinton and Yeltsin's period has ended with a cooling of the relationship, but not with such profound deterioration. And I would say, living in Russia through the Yeltsin's and Putin's era, I would say that we at the moment, by the way, complaining about the American role, we overestimated the American input. An American driver or American variable during the Yeltsin's transformation, this is second. And thirdly, I am not in a position, of course, to advise the American administration, but on the part of the Russian liberal minority or ghetto, tiny, tiny liberal ghetto minority, I would say that what we would anticipate from the U.S. administration. Firstly, understanding of what's happening in Russia. Secondly, maybe a humble approach and do no harm policy. Thirdly, engagement on all fronts. And fourthly, practice what you preach.
Les, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Lilia Shevtsova, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Lilia Shevtsova, senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center, also with us here in Studio 3A today. Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association. Appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
Coming up, and you'll want to stay awake for this, sleep and why we never seem to get enough. Not only that, but we make excuses for not getting more rest. An expert on sleep joins us next. Tell us your excuses. Why don't you get enough sleep at night? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Here are headlines from some of the other stories we're following here today at NPR News. President Bush has urged 15 major nations to agree on a global emissions goal to reduce greenhouse gases. Today, the president called for a series of meetings bringing together countries identified as major emitters of greenhouse gases. And a high-ranking lawyer fighting her demotion has sued General Electric, accusing the company of gender discrimination. The lawsuit alleges that GE pays female lawyers and women in entry-level executive jobs less than men. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow at Science Friday, Ira Flatow will be here with a look at genetics and breast cancer, plus reducing carbon in the atmosphere and new ways to produce hydrogen. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. A good night's sleep, 8 solid hours. When's the last time you had one? Some of us suffer from sleep disorders. Others can't sleep due to other medical problems. But for most of us, there's no excuse, which doesn't stop us from inventing one. New polling numbers show that sleep time in the U.S. continues to decline. Experts say we're in denial, that we lie to ourselves that we really only need 4 to 5 hours a night, or 100 other rationalizations. So what is your excuse? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. And you can also excuse yourself on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now is Dr. William Dement. He's the chief of the Stanford University Division of Sleep, and he's been studying sleep medicine for over 55 years. He joins us today from the studios at Stanford University in California. And Dr. Dement, it's nice to talk to you again.
Well, it's nice to talk to you.
We last spoke on this program 10 years ago. Do we get
that long?
That long. Do we get less sleep now than we did a decade ago?
Probably. I think that it's slowly going down. It's often difficult, you know, to really, really know what everybody is doing is a little difficult, but polls definitely show that.
Mm-hmm. And these are not necessarily scientific surveys, but polls show a trend that is shorter and shorter amounts of sleep.
That's correct. And that means there's a higher and higher risk for, you know, negative consequences, falling asleep at the wheel, that sort of thing.
And safety, falling asleep at the wheel, that sort of thing, as you say, these are real issues. This is not a joke.
No, not at all. It's a devastating negative consequence. You know, and when someone falls, like a truck driver, falls asleep at the wheel, I think 8 innocent victims are killed in a fatal to the driver truck accident.
Hmm.
And then the mistakes, and someone forgetting to convert inches to centimeters in the $6 billion mistake in the Mars mission.
A lack of sleep, you suspect.
I suspect. I always suspect that.
Well, that's your job, isn't it? Now, this ability of the human mind, though, to tell itself reasons why it doesn't get enough sleep and to rationalize them, this is powerful, isn't it?
Very powerful, and mainly it's ignorance, and you know, we're ignorant about sleep disorders. We have right now we're carrying out the largest clinical trial on treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, but it's amazing people don't know they have this illness, and yet there's a very, very effective treatment. And by the way, we could use a few more subjects. We're winding up this study.
And do you have to be in California to be a subject of this study?
No, it's actually in five cities: Boston, Tucson, Walla Walla, Washington, Stanford, and St. Louis. The number to call, I'll just say it, sleep.fmri@yahoo.com.
Now that's the we'll get somebody, one of our nimble fingered production assistants, to scribble that down. We'll put it on our website for those of you
terrific
who didn't get it down quickly enough, so that we'll have that at npr.org/talk. Dr. Dement, as we listen to people's excuses here, Tim in Pinedale, New York: I am constantly sleep deprived due to World of Warcraft, as I'm sure many of the other 8 million players are as well. Playing regularly keeps me up until 2 or 3 a.m. At work, I make up for it with at least 8 shots of espresso a day, so it's not a problem yet, he adds.
Well, I think what most people don't realize is it is a problem. And we've actually been studying this very, very closely in recent years, that if you take any individual and have them get extra sleep, their performance improves. And, you know, it's always like, here's my personal best, you know, I'm at my personal, it gets better. And that's a big surprise.
Yet people say, there's so many demands on my time. I've got work, I've got kids, I've got, I'm supposed to be, my doctor tells me I'm supposed to be getting exercise every day as well. You've got to burn the candle on at least one end.
Well, that's, I think what I say is that, you know, we have all these demands, all these reasons, all these things we must do, and we don't have a good, solid knowledge about sleep to sort of, you know, oppose all that and say, okay, I know that I've got to sleep or this will happen to me, or or my ability to do something will decrease. But people don't honestly know that. We were studying basketball players recently, and, you know, they have a personal best. I can shoot 7 out of 10 foul shots, and that's my absolute best. They get extra sleep, it becomes 8 out of 10. And it's, you know, that's, people need to know that.
Let's get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join us, by the way, it's 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Lisa's with us. Lisa calling from North Carolina.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was wondering what we would do about a husband who you love very dearly and you want to sleep in the same room and be next to him at night, but he snores like,
yeah,
like a bear. It's an awful, awful problem in trying to get rest.
No, this is a very serious problem. It's an, you know, due to a small airway, having tonsils and adenoids, big tongue. Probably the only effective way to deal with this is surgical, but it's much more important than people realize, because recent studies have shown that if you sleep with someone who snores loudly all night long, you are paying a price. You know, your waking performance is impaired. You
absolutely
aren't doing things as well as you could. Now, whether you can actually get this done or not, I'm not sure, because it's not something that is has really in the mainstream healthcare system, you know, treating snoring. But it's certainly a problem at a university where, you know, you have a snoring roommate, for example, and then you are sleepy all day long, you don't do as well in class.
Roommates are easier to change than spouses.
That's true.
And
that's very wise.
These apnea machines, how effective are those? My in-laws, both of them have one of those, and they take them on trips so that they can sleep in the same hotel.
They're very effective. Now, here's if there's snoring and then a pause, then that must be treated with the continuous positive airway pressure machine. And you can use it for just, you know, when people say benign snoring, I don't think there is any such thing, because it means that airflow is impaired if you snore. So
now,
snoring.
These devices, though, they do look like they're manufactured by Torquemada Enterprises.
Well, people swear by them, and I guess maybe a certain percentage find it intolerable. And at that point, you know, you have to do something else. So there are dental splints, and I think the surgical approach, the beauty of the surgical approach, if insurance covers it, is that it's, you know, forever. It's a lifetime. You don't have to worry about it again.
All right.
Whereas wearing the mask, you know, is for the rest of your life.
Thank you for your help.
And good luck, Lisa.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get, this is Bob. Bob's on the air from Wisconsin.
Yes, from Darlington, Wisconsin.
Go ahead, please.
And I've been retired for a number of years, and I've had an opportunity to turn on my radio at night between 8:30 and 9 o'clock and listen to NPR. They have wonderful programs, and I listen maybe till 11 o'clock, and then I'm kind of tired, and then I turn off the radio and fall asleep quite nicely, and I get my 7-8 hours sleep.
That sounds like a fine formula, as long as you don't adapt it to the middle of the day.
That's right.
Yeah, all I can say is congratulations.
Well, I just sort of fell into this pattern, and I didn't know how it was going to work out, but it just worked out beautifully, especially on Saturday and Sunday night when Norman Gilliland has the old-time radio programs, or the Lone Ranger.
Really?
Nothing easier to fall asleep to than Fibber, McGee, and Molly.
That's exactly right. So it seems to work beautifully for me, and then at the end of the sleep time, it seems like I've had my, at least 7.5-8 hours sleep, so that's not bad.
Not bad at all. Dr. DeMent, is it true that it's harder to get 8 hours of sleep as we get older?
Yes, but the actual need for sleep probably decreases somewhat, at least by an hour, from young adulthood to elderly. And I think that the key is not so much saying I need a certain amount of sleep, but if I feel wide awake, rested, and, you know, energetic and wanting to do things throughout the entire day, then you are getting the sleep you need.
Yeah, could I say something?
Go ahead, Bob.
If I sleep like 7 hours, let's say, I'm 75 years old now, and if I sleep the reasonable 7 hours, I feel quite refreshed.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But and that's much less than that, well, then it's a little more uncomfortable, right?
Exactly.
All right, Bob.
Thank you very much.
And have a good night.
Yeah.
All right, bye-bye.
Yes.
Here's an email from Bill. I try to get by on 5 hours per day. There's too much life to live. I'll sleep when I'm dead.
No, I'd say, the choice is going through life, losing an hour of sleep a night, going through life as a zombie, or giving up that 1 hour of being a zombie for wide awake, alert, and at your personal best all day long. And I think the main thing is a lot of people just haven't experienced that since they were kids. So that when we actually do our sleep debt reductions maneuvers, people say, oh my God, I haven't felt this great, you know, for years. I didn't realize. And then they're motivated to maintain the schedule.
Let's this is Wyatt. Wyatt's with us from Minnesota.
Hi. My question was, how do naps relate to your needs for sleep time? For example, last night I slept 4 hours, and I'm at work right now, and when I get home, I'll probably take a 3-hour nap. Does that mean that I'm reset?
Well, it can reset, but most people who nap, they can maintain their schedule, and certainly if you lose sleep at night, a nap in the daytime is a good idea. I thought you were going to say, how do you nap? Everybody has their own little style.
Mm-hmm. What is a useful nap? Is 10 or 20 minutes useful? Do you need to get 40 minutes or an hour and a half to get a full rhythm in?
I think that there's kind of a miraculous, and most people will report this, if they feel sleepy, their eyelids want to close, and they let it happen and sleep for 5 minutes to 10 minutes, when they awaken, they're very refreshed, and it's kind of hard to explain. If you really, really want to replace lost sleep, again, it's probably a longer nap. But I think that a very short nap it's like going over some sort of boundary into sleepiness, and you get a little bit of sleep can get you back across that boundary so that you can keep your eyes open and, you know, continue to drive or whatever it is you're doing.
Wyatt, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Dr. William DeMent, chief of the Stanford University Division of Sleep, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And an email here from Neil. I was a soldier in the U.S. Army stationed in Iraq in 2003. Army doctrine is that soldiers are only required 4 hours of uninterrupted sleep in a 24-hour period to maintain combat operation functionality. In my experience, he writes, this was not enough by a large margin.
And he's absolutely right, and I'm aware of this erroneous doctrine. It's also at the Great Lakes Naval Training Station where we've had the same thing. I think we've managed to change that because, almost no one can get along on 4 hours of sleep a night. And I think you get errors, friendly fire, all kinds of bad things happen. The Army should be well rested.
Anybody with automatic weapons should be well rested. I think we can all agree on that. Here's an email from Perry in Portland, Oregon. I put off sleep because life is so full of activities I love to do. I love what I do for a living, love exercising, love to eat, love to ride my bike, meditating and writing. Who has time for sleep when life is so full and fulfilling? And it's even more so during daylight savings when the sun's setting between 8 and 9 p.m. and the day's being so beautiful, I want to stay out longer. There's just so much so many of us want to do.
Well, I think that some people do need less sleep, but I think the things like when we studied meditation some years ago and all these meditators, it was sleep. They would all fall asleep. So I think that people are not sufficiently aware of how they're functioning and what they're doing. So if you're doing things that are very, very active, yes, it's easy to stay awake, but not meditation or studying.
Let's talk with, who's this, Harvey. Harvey's with us from Coral Gables in Florida.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask about any research that's been done relative to like a natural circadian rhythm for human beings. If we didn't know, if it was day or night, what might that cycle tend to look like in hours or days or whatever? Has there been any relevant research on that lately?
Yeah, this is my excuse that I'm actually an alien from a 27-hour planet.
That's possible. There has been enormous amount of research in the time isolation facilities in both Europe and the United States, and there is a natural period for human beings, which is the average is, believe it or not, 24 hours and 11 minutes. There are some individual differences in that, and then what is the most important thing is how that cycle relates to time of day, so that the alert phase can be early for some people or it can be very, very late. It certainly tends to be very, very late in college students who, for example, at Stanford, I think the average bedtime is 2:30 a.m. And then, of course, there's difficulty getting up in the morning.
Here's a related email from Suzanne in Philadelphia. I don't get enough sleep at night because I am on a non-24-hour sleep cycle. As a blind person with no light perception and no retina, I don't have the same ability to metabolize melatonin in the same way as most people. That may be an oversimplification, but I find the subject fascinating.
Yes, that's it's almost certainly true. We studied several blind individuals, and they could not adjust to a 24-hour day, so that we either had to, they had to be knowledgeable and just do what they could and time their activities, or we could manipulate their sleep cycle with medication, and then synchronize it.
Harvey, thanks for the call. Let's see if we can squeeze one last caller in. This is David. David with us from Syracuse, New York.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I wanted to ask about sleep prescriptions. The ones that have been tried for me, chloral hydrate, Benadryl, other things, I have a very light dreaming sleep, not a restful sleep, and so I wind up more tired than without the prescription. So I was wondering why the sleep prescriptions do that in just giving me a light dreaming sleep, not a restful sleep.
Yeah. Well, the names you mentioned are very, very old and in a sense have long since been discarded by physicians. There are four or five more recently evaluated sleep medications, and they require a doctor's prescription, but they're safe and very effective.
Such as?
Well, there's Ambien, Rosaram, these are trade names, Lunesta and Sonata.
Good luck with those, David.
Okay.
I just wanted to end with this quote that you gave at something called the Orlando Conference, that an individual's sleep is normal and adequate should never be taken for granted by anyone. The more correct assumption would be that until proven otherwise, their sleep is either inadequate, abnormal, or both. Dr. Dement, thanks very much for being with us today.
I stand by that.
William Dement, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Technology gives many disabled people the ability to participate in competitive athletics, and the Paralympics are now well established alongside the Olympic Games. Now, Oscar Pistorius, a double amputee from South Africa, wants to race on prosthetics on the big stage against the best two-legged sprinters in the world. The international governing body on track and field declared that his prosthetics are springs, which give him an unfair advantage. But the case raises questions about technology and fairness. Are carbon fiber legs different from the glasses that correct the vision of a competitive archer, or the LASIK eye surgery that gave Tiger Woods better than 20/20 vision? What about the operation that replaces the blown tendon in the arm of a baseball pitcher with a stronger one from another part of his body? As technology improves, will athletes install artificial knees? Where do you draw the line between giving athletes the ability to compete and a level playing field? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, we'll talk with basketball vagabond Paul Shirley about life in the NBA and many lesser leagues. But first, Bionic Jocks, and we begin with Jerry Longman, a reporter for the New York Times. He's with us on the phone from his hotel room outside of Detroit. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Oscar Pistorius's bid to compete in the Olympics and why it's so controversial.
Well, Oscar is a 20-year-old sprinter from South Africa whose times in the 100 meters, 200 meters, and 400 meters are beginning to approach Olympic qualifying standards. So it's raised, you know, there's a kind of natural tension at play between the right to compete and the right to fair play. So the International Track and Field Federation has made a preliminary ruling disallowing springs or wheels or those kind of devices that may give athletes an unfair advantage.
So it's not against prosthetics per se. If he was a sprinter who had a prosthetic arm, that wouldn't be a problem.
No, exactly. As a matter of fact, there's as much concern that able-bodied athletes may begin using, you know, some sort of springy device or, you know, in their shoes or things like that. So it's not just even a ruling looking strictly at disabled athletes.
And is there concern down the road that as technology improves, people may want to, some might call it self-mutilation, others might call it improvement, put things in their bodies that would make them more competitive?
There is that concern, although, you know, for many years, athletes have manipulated themselves in many ways. As you mentioned earlier, you know, LASIK surgery to improve your vision, equipment, swimming, you know, the swimsuits are made to make athletes much quicker in the water, you know, mm-hmm. aerodynamically, and track suits. So in many ways, athletes sleep in chambers to simulate high altitude and increase oxygen carrying capacity. So in many ways, they manipulate themselves already. The key is finding sort of an objective point at where therapy becomes enhancement. And I think that's what the International Track Federation is up against to decide, you know, at what point do Oscar's legs move from therapy or a corrective device to a device that gives him enhancement in performance.
And I guess this goes into the realm of drugs as well. You mentioned the hyperbaric chamber. That's okay. Blood doping is not.
No, and the next thing on the horizon is gene doping, where essentially the theory is that by using a benign virus and injecting it into your muscles that you'll be able to TiVo, you know, fast twitch muscles the way you TiVo television programs now, and the only way to detect that will be a muscle biopsy. So the advance of technology is, you know, is forcing sports officials to confront this notion of, you know, where does the right to compete conflict with fair playing field, level playing field.
And they would say that perhaps Mr. Pistorius' best place to run is in the Paralympic Games, but others would say, wait a minute, as distinguished as that is, as important as that is compared to the Olympic Games, it's a sideshow.
Right, and his argument is that, well, you know, it's not an advantage at all. I don't have my two lower legs, and the prosthetic legs give you less of an energy return than natural legs do. When he runs into a wind, his legs, the rotational forces tend to turn his prosthetic devices sideways, so he can't start in the same way that an able-bodied sprinter can. He basically has to stand up and just start running instead of being in a more aerodynamic position. So, you know, he's up against a lot of things.
And so, he can't get down into that sprinter's crouch and explode out of it the way other two fully abled sprinters do.
No, he I mean, the way able-bodied sprinters, they don't just pop up and run. This is called the drive phase or the transitional phase, where they come up to guard against wind resistance, and they come up gradually and reach their peak form, you know, further down the track. He basically has to pop up and sprint in very choppy steps. It takes him about 30 meters or so to get his full speed going. And the concern, the primary concern among officials at the International Track Federation is that Oscar had both legs amputated below the knee when he was 11 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no way to know how fast he would have been on natural legs versus prosthetic legs. And there's no precise way to know how tall he would have been. There's some feeling among track officials and some competitors that the prosthetic devices he uses make him taller than he would have been naturally and may give him a longer stride than he would have had. And speed is a product of the length of stride and the frequency of stride. Although there's not been much science done, and I think that's Oscar's point, is that, well, you can't prove that there's, you know, that I have this sort of advantage or that my stride is too long.
Mm-hmm.
And he's afraid that decisions are being made on supposition rather than on science. And I think everyone agrees that more science has to be done.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's start with Karen. Karen on the line with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi.
My comment is that, not to descend into being maudlin, but isn't the Olympic spirit supposed to be about overcoming hardships and trials and triumphing in the end? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Karen, thanks very much.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the sports ethicists I talked to said that's the problem with making a rash, you know, a hasty decision to ban Oscar, is that that's one of, you know, he's overcome an incredible hardship, and that's one of the fundamental principles of the Olympics.
And therefore, should it be an exception, or should there be just a philosophical rethinking?
Well, I think everyone is calling for instance, since 2004, transgender athletes are allowed to compete in the Olympics. So they, you know, scientists determined a point at which everyone could agree that you know, after taking hormones for a certain period, that if you say you were male athlete who became a female athlete,
mm-hmm.
there's a, you know, a prescribed period of time you have to take hormones, and there's an agreement that after a certain period that your muscle building capacity would be lessened enough that you could compete against other women in a fair way. So people are calling for that same way with prosthetic devices. You have to make a an objective, defined point where, as I said, where therapy becomes enhancement. And until that's done, it's going to be, I think, very difficult to say, okay, you can't compete here or something, because there just hasn't been the science yet.
Wheels is the other, the springs, the carbon fiber legs, I guess, qualify as springs. Wheels, there are some wheelchair athletes who say they should be allowed to compete in races too.
Well, for a long time, I mean, there are limits placed on technology. There have been historically. I mean, you know, the pole vault, the pole used in a pole vault at one point, you know, was before it was made out of carbon fiber, was, you know, didn't bend as much. Or
right, bamboo, yeah.
And there were, you know, the design of the javelin has been changed so it doesn't fly as long as it used to, and so it won't become a dangerous weapon. So wheelchair athletes are not allowed to compete in the Olympic marathon, for instance, because they're much faster. It would give you a half an hour advantage or so competing in a wheelchair versus an able-bodied runner. So there have historically been limits.
Here's an email from Rory in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm an individual who is a paraplegic athlete, and through integration of individuals with disabilities with able-bodied individuals is a step in the right direction and noble prospect. I believe that certain prosthetics can give advantages that do not provide a level playing field as a whole. We can all get fancy equipment, but where do we draw the line to give one's self-enhancement opportunities to compete?
Well, that's the question that ethicists or and sports officials are going to be faced with increasingly, I think, in the coming years. I mean, in February, a high jumper named Jeff Skiba, who has one leg amputated below the knee, competed in the United States Indoor Track and Field Championships against able-bodied athletes. And in March, Oscar Pistorius of South Africa finished second in the 400 meters against able-bodied runners in the South African Championships. So as disabled athletes gain access to better coaching, better training methods, and their performances increase, we're that question is where do you draw the line is going to become increasingly urgent to answer.
Let's talk with Eddie. Eddie's on the line with us from Sacramento.
Hello. My grandpa played football back in the 40s for the NFL, and he always talked about how they didn't have weight programs and things like that, and once that kind of started, everybody started doing it. And I think that this is just another one of those things where once somebody does it, it's going to be the natural, well, not, it's kind of unnatural at this point, but the natural evolution of things that athletes do to better themselves.
Yep.
It's going to start happening.
It's already happening, I guess. But the question we're asking is where do you draw the line? I mean, could you have some metal reinforcement put into a halfback's arm so that when he gives that forearm shiver, it has a completely different effect?
That's true. I think they should draw the line to the point of, was it necessary that they had that? Did they have an injury where it was necessary not to necessarily make the bionic man out there? But I think that it's going to happen whether we like it or not.
Hmm.
I mean, it's just going to, it's going to, like anything else, like any technology.
As Eddie says, Jerry Longman, this is an issue that's not going away. It's going to raise more and more questions.
Oh, sure. I mean, we've, in the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, Marla Runyon, a legally blind athlete, competed in the, she reached the final of the metric mile of 1500 meters, became the first Paralympic athlete to compete in the Olympics.
Wow.
So, this, this question of where do you draw the line? I mean, that's a very urgent question. If you include the doping situation, maybe the most urgent question in sports today. And the answer is we don't know the answer at this point. That'll be left to scientists and sports officials and ethicists to figure out. At what point, whatever technological device is it available to everyone? Is it does it give you, as I say, does it turn from a corrective device to an enabling device? I mean, those are the kind of questions they're going to have to answer.
Thanks very much for the call, Eddie. And Jerry Longman, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jerry Longman's a reporter for the New York Times with us today from his hotel room outside of Detroit, Michigan. When we come back from the break, we'll be talking with a member of the IAAF Council, the people who decide about things like, springs and wheels. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about bionic jocks and where you draw the line between disabled and enhanced. A double amputee who sprints on two carbon fiber legs has been told he cannot compete in the Olympic Games because his prosthetic legs give him an unfair advantage. Other athletes have LASIK surgery or elbow surgery to help them compete. Where's the line between giving athletes the ability to compete and a level playing field? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also give us your thoughts on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. With us now is Bob Hirsch. He's a member of the IAAF Council. The International Association of Athletics Federations is the world governing body for track and field. Bob's in a studio at member station WRHU in Long Island. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you're a member. You're not the person who actually makes the decision yourself, right?
Well, I'm one of the people. I mean, actually, the rules are passed by the entire IAAF Congress, which is every one of our 211 or 12 members. But the council makes recommendations to the Congress, and the council has passed an interim rule that affects the devices and wheels and springs and such when they convey an unfair advantage.
Now, when did this come up? Was this in the case of Oscar Pistorius, or has this been under consideration for some time?
Well, what has been in the rules for some time is the concept that you can't use things that give you an unfair advantage. We certainly are aware of the Pistorius situation, but the concept that equipment can't give you an unfair advantage is very much ingrained in our rules. For shoes, for instance, we have a specific rule that says the shoe cannot incorporate any technology that will give the wearer any unfair advantage. So the rule that we passed, which deals with any technical device that incorporates springs, wheels, or any other element that provides the user with an advantage over another athlete not using such a device, I just see as an extension of that principle.
Mm-hmm. And have tests been done to find out, in fact, whether, as you know, Mr. Pistorius says his prosthetics don't give him an advantage. In fact, that he gets less return of energy from his carbon fiber legs than regular athletes do from their regular legs. So at that point, is there a test available?
Well, I believe this matter has been referred to our technical people, who will determine how best to determine it. But if I may, let me comment on something that was said earlier.
Sure.
We have not told Mr. Pistorius, I don't believe anybody has told Mr. Pistorius, that he cannot compete in the Olympic Games. And we haven't banned prosthetic legs. The only thing we've done is establish, reconfirm as a principle, that we cannot accept technical devices that provide the user with an advantage over somebody not using such a device.
So is his application pending then?
Well, I don't know that he's formally applied, but we are aware of it, and I believe that people in our technical area will be doing the necessary biomechanical investigation to determine whether his particular prosthesis does or does not convey an unfair advantage.
So if the test comes out in his favor, he does apply, he might be accepted.
Oh, sure. I mean, in the first place, the Olympics are a long way off. We have two world championships between now and then, outdoors this year and indoors next year, plus a lot of competition. Theoretically, this could apply anywhere. We have a major IAAF Grand Prix meet here in New York on Saturday. I don't believe Mr. Pistorius is going to compete, but anybody involved in the sport of athletics in international competition year-round and around the world would be subject to this rule.
Mm-hmm. This is, you would think, the example was raised in Jerry Longman's article. How is this different from something like, and this may not affect your particular field, but just as a theory, how is this different from a LASIK surgery for somebody who's in a sport where vision is important, for example?
I don't know. I mean, I think it would be somebody mentioned the golf example.
Sure.
I think it would be up
Tiger
to the
Woods,
it would be up to the golf people to determine whether that's fair or unfair. I can easily imagine they're thinking, well, anybody could get glasses that correct vision to whatever extent he has it, so maybe it's not unfair. I just don't know. I think again, the concept, the determination of what's fair and what's not fair, has to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that point has been made earlier, that certain prostheses can be an advantage, and others may not be. And we certainly are not banning all prostheses. We're not banning competition by people with prosthetic legs. We have to make it on a case-by-case determination. Whatever we determine, I think, would apply not only to sprinters. Jerry Longman mentioned sprinters, and Pistorius is a sprinter, but
right.
it's possible that in a longer distance event where the mechanics of the start are not as relevant, that there could be something that incorporated springs or wheels or something that could really convey an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Dave. Dave's with us from San Francisco.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air, Dave. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm just curious if there has been any preliminary studies or comparisons between, somebody like Oscar and elite athletes with respect to VO2 max or cardiac output. I mean, that seems like a pretty basic sign of whether or not something like prosthetic limbs would be giving an advantage or not. I know these elite athletes typically have much higher VO2 maxes and cardiac outputs, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Dave, thanks very much. And would those be among the kinds of tests the technical people might undertake?
I don't know, and I'm not aware of any tests on Oscar or anybody else in that situation. I think really we were looking more, and I at least was thinking more, of the biomechanical aspects of the device.
So the spring aspect.
The spring aspect. Yes.
And presumably that same thing applies to wheels.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think Jerry's quite correct in saying that if you allow wheelchair. And by the way, you may be aware there's been some litigation here in the United States seeking to establish the right of a wheelchair competitor to compete against runners. Well, if you know, at any distance, appreciable distance at all, there will be a real advantage. And it really would change the sport,
mm-hmm.
not in a way that anybody would think is a good idea. At least I wouldn't.
get Steve on the line, and Steve's calling us from Ann Arbor in Michigan. Steve, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
My comment is, it's certainly an oversimplified view of it, but I kind of feel that it's really competition. If you can't compete, you pretty much lose, and that's kind of the end of the story. And but I also have a question regarding the legality of it, and where does this put the Olympic Society in terms of countries like the U.S. that have anti-discrimination laws regarding disabilities? And mm-hmm. I realize that they're an international organization, so that might nullify them from those effects, but does that really affect them?
Discrimination laws, do they come into this, do you think, Robert Hirsch?
I think they could, but in a circumstance where there's an obvious nexus between the regulation of the sports officials and the competitive aspect of the sport, I believe that a rule such as this would be upheld.
Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's talk now with Brian Fraser. Brian is a Paralympic athlete and works in the prosthetic industry, fitting people with new prosthetics. He joins us by phone from Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. And Brian Fraser, nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've competed against able-bodied athletes. Why is it important that people with prosthetics be able to compete with able-bodied athletes?
Well, I think we have to back up and talk a little bit more about, I came onto this call a little bit late as far as the discussion was concerned,
mm-hmm.
but when we're talking about whether or not sprinting feet pose an advantage for an amputee athlete, there's a lot of other things we're going to have to consider, and that's why I think it's going to be important for the IAAF to include experts from the prosthetic field who have biomechanical backgrounds and expertise in that area, because you can't just consider the response of the prosthetic foot itself. You have to look at how the amputee's gait is affected by the socket that their leg fits into. That comes up in cusps around the knee, and that interferes with their range of motion. So there's a lot of other things that really inhibit the amputee runner besides the foot itself. And to the question is, are there that or are there studies that have been done to compare the efficiencies between able-bodied persons and amputees? And there certainly are. And all of the data suggests that amputees are at a disadvantage from an efficiency standpoint. There's several studies that's been done to compare walking with prosthetic feet to able-bodied walkers, and it shows that a single below-the-knee amputee is at they use 25% more oxygen to do the same sort of activities as an able-bodied person. Now, as that amputation moves up, such as an above-the-knee amputee, a bilateral amputee, such as Oscar, those deficiencies increase. And so we would have to assume, even though there hasn't been any specific studies done on the running prosthetics, such as the cheetahs, we would have to assume that many of those deficiencies carry over to running as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, in regards to that, I would have to say that, you know, my view, both as a prosthetist and as an amputee sprinter as well, who has actually made Oscar's first set of sprinting feet that he competed on in Athens, I've competed against him and trained with him. And as a single below-the-knee amputee myself, who was a sprinter before I lost my leg, I've yet to run times on my prosthetic limb that have exceeded the times I was running as an able-bodied athlete. And so that tells me, from a personal standpoint, I don't think the leg is an advantage. And just from everything I've seen, I think that it's important to the fact that you have athletes here who are training as elite athletes who, for a long time, have gone unrecognized for their accomplishments. And even though there's been a certain amount of coverage with the Paralympics, now we've approached a point where there's possible integration between those two. And I feel that the initial response from everybody that's been involved with this is more out of a response of not having a lot of education in the area, maybe some fear of integration of the two, versus really wanting to look at the hardcore data to say, okay, running on prosthetics is an advantage or it isn't.
Could you describe these legs for the cheetah, obviously named after the African cat?
Yeah, it was actually a name that came about that was named by the athletes themselves. It was actually called the Flex Run 3, but the cheetahs, or the athletes affectionately called it the cheetahs, just because if you look at it, it almost resembles the hind leg of a cheetah. And so it was a name that caught on early on once the foot was introduced into the prosthetic market. And that was back in 96, and so the foot's been around for quite some time, and it's probably the closest thing I felt as a amputee sprinter and being an able-bodied sprinter before that as far as this response. But as far as feeling like it gives me more of a response than my sound side, I would say no. And there's even been some more recent studies to suggest that when you look at the comparison between a prosthetic and an able-bodied person as far as looking at their calf, their ankle and their gastroc.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing we have to keep in mind is that the Oscar and myself, we're running on passive prosthetics. That means it's basically a dead material. It's not like we're running on bionic products that have a motor incorporated into it or something of that nature where we're getting mechanical power from the prosthesis.
But isn't it? Doesn't it form the shape of a spring?
It forms the shape of a J, which that is the key to it being able to be loaded, and it is that's where it stores energy. So it does have the capability of storing energy and releasing energy. But the thing you have to keep in mind is that the best that can ever be is going to be 100%, which it is not, because there's always a certain percentage of energy loss through heat dissipation.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say that it's maybe 90 to 95% efficient. So that means it gives back to 90 to 95% of the energy that I put into it. A human ankle, foot system, and gastroc can return up to 250 times the amount of force applied to the ground. And that's because we have the ability to contract the gastroc muscle.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really don't want to get excessively technical, but let's pause for just a minute. We're talking with Paralympic athlete Brian Fraser and with Robert Hirsch, a member of the IAAF, that's the International Association of Athletics Federations Council. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted Robert Hirsch to give you the chance to respond to Brian's points and suggestions.
Well, thank you. That's all very interesting, and I think many of the points that Brian made are relevant things that I think our technical people will need to get will need to take a look at. One of the points that I think we also need to think about, and Brian, I think the amputee community needs to think about, is whether there's a need for regulation within the community of people who are running with prosthetic devices. I'll give you an example. We regulate all sorts of implements in the IAAF. As you may know, a javelin has very specific requirements for size, shape, weight, contour, surface, and center of gravity. And if you change any of those things, if you alter the javelin, you could change the aerodynamics and get an advantage. And the principle that has driven our thinking has been that we want our competitions to be competitions between athletes and not between manufacturers. And the same thought process could apply to prosthetic devices. Is there a point at which there could be such a competition among the manufacturers of different kinds of devices that it would change the nature of that competition?
Brian?
Well, I think that, again, that largely has to do with the type of prosthetic that we're talking about, and that's why I alluded to a passive prosthetic versus a bionic prosthetic. And there certainly is technology and work being done on bionics right now. And I think that eventually there will be prosthetics manufactured that has the capability of responding with a motorized or mechanical force that would be greater than a human could do, the same as once cars were evolved, and they go much faster than we could ever run or whatnot. But the fact of the matter is, though, is that most amputee runners at this time are unilateral, meaning that they're missing one leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so by that respect, they're largely governed by their sound side. It would be pointless to make a prosthesis that could respond better than their sound side because that would create asymmetry in the running gait.
Yeah, but getting back to Robert's point, if one runner is using your cheetah leg and another runner is using somebody else's design, isn't it in some respects a competition between these mechanical devices and their manufacturers and not between the athletes?
Well, the thing to consider in the Paralympics is that all of the athletes, all of the sprinters, are running on the same technology, and they have the access to the same technology. And the way that I would compare that is, even though I know it's regulated within NASCAR,
mm-hmm.
Everybody's pretty even when you look at the engines and whatnot of cars racing against each other in NASCAR, because everybody has the same access to the same sorts of parts and engines.
Yeah.
And that's the same way that it is in the Paralympics right now. Everybody has access to the same technology. Whether that individual athlete chooses to use that or not is up to them.
Finally, let me ask you, Robert Hirsch,
yeah.
As you say, these are case-by-case basis. As technology improves, these are questions that are going to keep coming up and coming up and coming up. As this is not going away anytime soon.
I think you're right. And let me say, Brian, I appreciate your thoughts. I think I would like to reach out to you and get further thinking from you because we are just getting into this area, And we do need all the technical advice that we can get. But I need to make it very clear again that we have not banned any particular kind of prosthetic. We haven't banned Oscar's prosthetic. And we do need to look at these on a case-by-case basis and make a determination of whether there's an advantage that we think is unfair.
That's great. All right. Robert Hirsch, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Robert Hirsch, member of the IAAF Council, and he joined us from member station WRHU on Long Island in New York. Brian Fraser, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Fraser is a Paralympic athlete, and he joined us by phone from Walter Reed Army Hospital here in Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll go from bionic jocks to bench warmer. Paul Shirley played for many different basketball teams in many different leagues in many different countries. He even played in Siberia. If you'd like to ask him about it, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Here are headlines from some of the stories we're following here today at NPR News. The man Britain is charged with poisoning former KGB officer Alexander Litvinenko says he thinks Britain was behind the murder. Andrei Lugovoy says he's been made the scapegoat as part of an attempt to embarrass Russia. And Apple's iTunes store has started selling thousands of songs without copy protection. The unrestricted content means some songs purchased from iTunes will work for the first time directly on portable players other than Apple's iPod. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow, it's Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here along with cosmologist Paul Davies. They'll discuss how the universe is just right for life. Plus, a new off-Broadway show tries to inspire conservation through poetry and science. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. Tonight, the Detroit Pistons host the Cleveland Cavaliers in Game 5 of the Eastern Conference Final, a pivotal game in the NBA playoffs with 20,000 people in attendance and millions more watching on cable TV. Paul Shirley played in some games where the crowd was counted in the low hundreds, and he had to take a basketball back with him to the motel to use for warm-ups the next day. Over 6 years, Shirley played in Greece, Russia, and Spain for minor league teams in places like Yakima and Kansas City. He played exhibition games on a team sponsored by a video game company. And yes, he played in the big time, the NBA, as well. He's written a book about his career as a professional basketball gypsy called Can I Keep My Jersey? If you have questions about hoop dreams and reality, about race and religion in basketball, or the life of a journeyman, our number is 800-989-8255, or you can also send us email, talk@npr.org. Paul Shirley joins us now from the studios of member station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. I'm a little depressed after listening to you list off that laundry list of places I've been. I feel like I should be 45 by now.
Sometimes I suspect in the mornings you feel like you're 45.
You're exactly right.
You describe it, there's a world of difference between the NBA and some of the scuffle-along leagues that you've played in, but not all that much difference in the talent and skills of the players.
Yeah, I think some people might assume that an NBA player is, say, three times better than a minor league player, but a lot of times it's maybe the NBA player is 10% better or something, and so that has allowed him to then make $2 million a year instead of $200 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that division is actually kind of amazing if you think about it, just that maybe that someone's 2 inches taller or can bench press 20 extra pounds is making his income 10 times as much.
Or that some NBA team made a mistake in drafting him and gave him a big contract, and he's continuing to get paid even though he's not so good.
Right. We have a few instances of those. That's true.
And the odd thing is you can be amongst the, best 500 basketball players in the world and still make peanuts.
Right. Although it is still getting paid to play a game, so I don't want to paint the picture that I'm too much of a misanthrope. It is fairly amazing that someone wants to pay me to put a ball in a basket.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just got back, as I understand it, from the Spanish island of Menorca, where you played for the local team there. Described, I think, as the worst team in European basketball?
Well, that's somewhat inaccurate. It was the worst team in the Spanish league. And the Spanish league is actually the second best league in the world behind, of course, the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
We were when I got there, the team was in last place. In European leagues, teams are relegated to the next division if they finish in one of the bottom two spots. So the goal was to finish in the highly mediocre place of third to last or better. And we actually accomplished that goal, which was the cause for much celebration. There were 5,000 Menorcans waiting for us when we got back from our last game, and we went up on the plaza of the city center and pontiff style spoke to the audience.
Hmm. There's a fascinating description. You'd played in the Spanish League earlier in your career in Barcelona, and you described this, A, that the European game is much more fun to watch, much more fun to play in, and that fans and players are much more passionate about it.
They seem to be. I think when you did the intro to this section and you mentioned that there was an NBA game tonight, I think half of your listeners may have tuned you out because the NBA just doesn't seem to inspire very many people in the U.S. anymore. It does that in Spain or in Greece, sometimes to the detriment of my forehead and such. People are not afraid to chuck coins at players. When I was in Spain, as you mentioned, at one point in warm-ups, a man I noticed whisper into his 8-year-old daughter's ear, and then she came sprinting down to the court in order to go double obscene gesture to me, which I felt was a little inappropriate for an 8-year-old.
There's also a passion by owners. You describe a game you played in Mexico. I think you were part of, was it the American Basketball Association at the time?
That is the erstwhile ABA, not the famous ABA of Julius Erving, but the infamous ABA of Tijuana and Juarez, etc.
And you noticed a bunch of phantom calls by the referee, fouls called on you and other players on your team that just didn't happen. And it turned out the referee came up to you guys after the game and said, look, I had to make some bad calls because I was getting death threats.
Right, which normally I wouldn't believe. If somebody told me that story, I'd say, that's wrong. You're making that up just to sound interesting. But this man was visibly shaken in the hotel in Juarez and actually did go about getting out of the country that night because he feared for his life.
We're talking with basketball player Paul Shirley. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. His book is called Can I Keep My Jersey? And, Paul, that goes back to an incident, I guess, in your first tryout camp just after you graduated from from Iowa State, and you were in tryout camp for the Lakers.
Right, and after being dutifully kicked to the curb because I really had no chance to make the team, I marched into the equipment manager's office and put on my best sad face and said, okay, well, so now that I'm going home, I assume that I can take my jersey with me because I don't know what you're going to do with a Lakers jersey with 45 and Shirley on the back. And the man there said, no, we're not a club that does that. And I burst into tears. Not really. I marched out and stole a pair of shoes to get back at the Lakers.
Were they your size shoes?
Yes. In fact, I think I may have taken two, which to me seemed like a huge victory, but I'm sure the Lakers didn't miss them at all.
Here's an email question from John in Urbandale, Iowa. How many jerseys do you actually do have?
I think I'm up to having played for 14 professional teams, and I have every jersey except for the Yakima Sun Kings, probably because they couldn't afford to give it to me, and the aforementioned Lakers.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't you get one made up?
I should do that, but then I wouldn't have the story, so it wouldn't be worthwhile.
The Yakima Sun Kings. Now, that was an interesting story. This is in the Continental Basketball Association, also erstwhile.
Well, it's, yes, somewhat maligned, however, slightly more historic. It's been around for 50 years before Isaiah Thomas ran it in the ground, before then running the
New
Toronto
York Knicks
Raptors
into
in
the ground.
And
the New York Knicks.
New York Knicks, right, exactly.
So,
but, yes, the Continental Basketball Association is the longtime minor league. It has now been supplanted by the NBA Developmental League, but the CBA has actually had kind of roaring success in these bizarre cities like Yakima, Washington, and Bismarck, North Dakota, probably because there's not a lot else to do there.
And you describe with some passion the difficulty of people who are 6'10" draping themselves across the streets, the seats of a bus for a long drive across the prairie.
Right. I was always disappointed by the scheduling abilities of the CBA office because we'd have to play back-to-back games, but those back-to-back games, one might be in Bismarck and then the next in Sioux Falls. And for people who are not familiar with the upper Midwest, those two cities are not close to one another.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Brett. Brett's with us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good. Well, Paul, I just love all the guest blogs, and I actually discovered you through the Sports Guy column on ESPN.com. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know what your future plans for writing were.
A fine question. The book's actually done better than Random House expected. They, like everyone else, think that all jocks are idiots, and I'm here to try to prove them wrong. I think someday I'd love to continue to pursue this. I don't know what opportunities I'll be given, because it'll be hard to convince people that I can write about something besides basketball, but hopefully there'll be that chance someday.
For those unfamiliar with the Sports Guy or ESPN, you started keeping journals on paper when you were playing in a league in Greece, I guess your first year in professional basketball, and that's evolved into a blog where you chronicle your efforts.
Right. When I first got to Greece, I didn't have very much internet access, so each week I would sit down and merrily type out my journals or diaries on my laptop and then send them home when I felt like I could splurge and spend 10 euros to go to the internet cafe. And so that continued over the next 4 years. And then when I was playing for the Phoenix Suns in 2004, 2005, they asked me to do a blog. And without knowing that I had actually done this and kind of built up my own shtick, as it were, before, that garnered a little attention from ESPN, and who then asked me to write a blog full time. Random House called, told me to ask me if I wanted to write a book. I said, why not? And here we are.
And here we are. Brett, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Now, you mentioned you were playing for the Phoenix Suns. You got to play. That team went pretty deep into the playoffs, and you were the 12th man.
Right, right, which is a lot better than not being on the team at all, right? People are quick to dismiss the 12th man, but it's a lot better than being the 13th man. That joke being that there are only 12 guys on the team, so it's better to be on the team and not playing than not on the team.
It must be difficult, though, when you're the 12th man, just to keep in shape. You hardly ever get into the game unless your team is either way ahead or way behind.
Right. It was always depressing in Phoenix after games. Other players who hadn't played, like myself and I, would go down to the practice court and run sprints after the game, which is not exactly the glory that people expect out of the NBA. We're in there while everyone else is celebrating in the locker room with the reporters around. We're down in the subterranean parts of America West Arena running wind sprints.
Though, like everybody who's been in a minor league, I heard this mostly from baseball players, when they get to the big league, the one thing that they express most amazement about is that they no longer have to carry their own bags.
Oh, it's unbelievable. The cosmic shift from riding in buses around the Dakotas to flying in chartered planes and staying in Ritz-Carltons and having someone cart your bags around is remarkable.
We're talking with Paul Shirley. His book is Can I Keep My Jersey, 11 Teams, 6 Years, 5 Countries, and My So-Called Career as a Professional Basketball Player. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Stephen on the line. Stephen's with us from Santa Rosa in California.
Hey, I had a quick question. I'm 43 years old. I've been playing basketball 25 years. I love it. But now my knowledge of the game is starting to outpace the capabilities of my body. What do I do to keep playing another 10 years or 15 years?
Well, I'm only 29, so while I do feel slightly aged, I don't know how much help I'm going to be. My encouragement, though, is to never sink into the temptation to be the old dirty guy on the court. Like, nobody likes to play with the guy who just takes out the other players. So when you can't do it anymore, walk away gracefully and find golf.
Okay.
Good. Four, Stephen. And I have to ask you, one of your more recent blogs was playing against the dirtiest player in history.
By the way, you are so well researched. It's amazing to me. I'm used to dealing with like sports radio guys who have no idea what's going on.
I aspire to sports radio.
It's impressive. I did talk about a guy in Spain who was dirty in the conventional sense, in the basketball sense, in that he was sort of not afraid to throw elbows around, but he also was literal about it in that I don't think he had showered in about 2 weeks, which was quite disgusting when he was ramming his armpits into my nose.
One of the things that I found interesting about your book is that you, for the most part, name names. When you describe Sharif Abdur-Rahim throwing away this huge parcel of fan mail that he received, and you were shocked that people took the effort to write you and you're throwing away, that you're not even looking at them, much less. And you name names. Has this been a problem for you and as you've been, your career as a 12th man?
Well, we'll see. I don't know that Sharif Abdur-Rahim, for example, is a very intelligent guy, well-read and all that, so he may know how to use the internet, but I don't know if that's true for everyone in the NBA, so it's not been a problem to this point. I don't know that to use a basketball euphemism, I suppose, I've not thrown that many people under the bus. I didn't go after people, but I do believe that these things happen, so it's not like I can undo them from the cosmic record, as it were. And if I say that it happened, and that doesn't change that it actually did. So I haven't felt really too many qualms about telling the truth.
Yet I don't suspect you're going to be invited over to Kobe Bryant's house for dinner anytime soon.
Probably not, but I don't think many people in the NBA are.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Nicole. Nicole with us from San Francisco. Nicole, you there?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Hi there. I had a question for Paul. I played soccer, and I played in college, and I played internationally for a bit. But I want to know, like, from my experiences, you're kind of always left wanting more. So in your experiences, was there ever a point where you felt, I'm a success, or I've made it, or this is as far as I've, you know, as far as I can go, or are you still wanting more and wanting more?
That is an astute question. I think, for me, growing up as a small-town kid who idolized Larry Bird, my only goal was to play in the NBA. And, of course, at some point I did that, which was amazing. I was in a hotel in Boise, Idaho, and got the call that I was going to get to play for the Atlanta Hawks. And I can never minimize just how just phenomenal that experience was. But you're right. Once I achieved that of actually playing in the NBA, I had to decide now what motivates me. And as hokey as it sounds, I guess for me it's always just to know that I'm putting everything I can into this to be as good as I can at basketball. And obviously I'm much more well known for being the guy who doesn't play, but it does remain a driving force just to be as good as I can at this game, whatever that is for me.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Nicole. But just to follow up on what she was asking, once you're the 12th man, is that's no longer good enough? You really want to be a starter?
Well, of course, I don't know that anyone could be satisfied. And my 12th man status was only while I played for the Phoenix Suns. While I played for the Bulls, for example, I was actually part of the rotation. And it just so happened that when I got to Phoenix, it worked out that I wasn't going to play very much. I think good basketball players understand their role, but they also are constantly, they're going to be competitive, and they're always going to want to play more. That's a natural instinct. So no one's ever going to be satisfied with not playing, but he can maybe make the best of it while he's there and write a blog that gets turned into a book.
One last question before we let you go. You're 29 years old. When will you know when you're done?
It's a great question. I've always assumed that I would blow out a knee or fall in love with some girl from Greece and that would be the end of it. But I think I will have to find a point that I am happy with my body of work and move on. So if you have any suggestions, feel free to send them my way.
I'm sure there's a league in Patagonia that could use you.
Right. I figure I should hit all 7 continents before I quit.
Paul Shirley, thanks very much for your time and good luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
Paul Shirley's book is called Can I Keep My Jersey? He joined us today from the studios of member station KCUR in Kansas City. If you'd like to read an excerpt from the book, you can go to our website, npr.org/talk. Ira Flatow will be here tomorrow on Science Friday. We'll see you Monday. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thanks for listening. To find an NPR station that carries Talk of the Nation or to find out how to join in our daily conversation, visit npr.org/talk.